more strictly and significantly, the lawyer's own professional code, doesn't allow them to. Lawyers must accept only one member of a couple as a client. The other person is turned from the door and either has no legal advice at all or is forced to go to another lawyer. And that is where the fun begins. In separate chambers, but with one voice, the two lawyers immediately start referring to us and them. Us, you understand, doesn't mean me and my wife. It means me and my lawyer against her and her lawyer. When the case comes to court, it is actually listed as Smith versus Smith. It is assumed to be adversarial, whether the couple feel adversarial or not, whether or not they have specifically agreed that they want to be sensibly amicable. And who benefits from treating it as an I-win-you-lose tussle? The chances are only the lawyers.
The hapless couple have been dragged into a zero-sum game. For the lawyers, however, the case of Smith and Smith is a nice, fat, non-zero-sum game, with the Smiths providing the payoffs and the two professionals milking their clients' joint account in elaborately coded cooperation. One way in which they cooperate is to make proposals that they both know the other side will not accept. This prompts a counterproposal that, again, both know is unacceptable, and so it goes on. Every letter, every telephone call exchanged between the cooperating adversaries adds another wad to the bill. With luck, this procedure can be dragged out for months or even years, with costs mounting in parallel. The lawyers don't get together to work all this out. On the contrary, it is ironically their scrupulous separateness that is the chief instrument of their cooperation at the expense of the clients. The lawyers may not even be aware of what they're doing. Like the vampire bats that we shall meet in a moment, they are playing to well-ritualized rules. The system works without any conscious overseeing or organizing. It is all geared to forcing us into zero-sum games. Zero-sum for the clients, but very much non-zero-sum for the lawyers. What is to be done? The Shakespeare option is messy. It would be cleaner to get the law changed. But most parliamentarians are drawn from the legal profession and have a zero-sum mentality. It's hard to imagine a more adversarial atmosphere than the British House of Commons. The law courts at least preserve the decencies of debate. As well they might, since my learned friend and I are cooperating very nicely all the way to the bank. Perhaps well-meaning legislators, and indeed contrite lawyers, should be taught a little game theory. It's only fair to add that some lawyers play exactly the opposite role, persuading clients who are itching for a zero-sum fight that they would do better to reach a non-zero-sum settlement out of court. What about other games in human life? Which are zero-sum and which non-zero-sum? And, because this is not the same thing, which aspects of life do we perceive as zero or non-zero-sum? Which aspects of human life foster envy and which foster cooperation against a banker? Think, for instance, about wage bargaining and differentials. When we negotiate our pay rises, are we motivated by envy or do we cooperate to maximize our real income? Do we assume, in real life as well as in psychological experiments, that we are playing a zero-sum game when we are not?
I simply pose these difficult questions. To answer them would go beyond the scope of this book. Football is a zero-sum game. At least it usually is. Occasionally it can become a non-zero-sum game. This happened in 1977 in the English Football League. Association football or soccer, the other games called football, rugby football, Australian football, American football, Irish football, etc., are also normally zero-sum games. Teams in the Football League are split into four divisions. Clubs play against other clubs within their own division, accumulating points for each win or draw throughout the season. To be in the first division is prestigious and also lucrative for a club, since it ensures large crowds. At the end of each season, the bottom three clubs in the first division are relegated to the second division for the next season. relegation seems to be regarded as a terrible fate worth going to great efforts to avoid. May the 18th, 1977 was the last day of that year's football season. Two of the three relegations from the First Division had already been determined, but the third relegation was still in contention. It would definitely be one of three teams, Sunderland, Bristol or Coventry. These three teams then had everything to play for on that Saturday. Sunderland were playing against a fourth team whose tenure in the First Division was not in doubt. Bristol and Coventry happened to be playing against each other. It was known that if Sunderland lost their game, then Bristol and Coventry needed only to draw against each other in order to stay in the First Division. But if Sunderland won, then the team relegated would be either Bristol or Coventry, depending on the outcome of their game against each other. The two crucial games were theoretically simultaneous. As a matter of fact, however, the Bristol-Coventry game happened to be running 5 minutes late. Because of this, the result of the Sunderland game became known before the end of the Bristol-Coventry game. Thereby hangs this whole complicated tale. For most of the game between Bristol and Coventry, the play was, to quote one contemporary news report, fast and often furious, an exciting, if you like that sort of thing, ding-dong battle. Some brilliant goals from both sides had seen to it that the score was 2-2 by the 80th minute of the match. Then, 2 minutes before the end of the game, the news came through from the other ground that Sunderland had lost. Immediately, the Coventry team manager had the news flashed up on the giant electronic message board at the end of the ground. Apparently all 22 players could read, and they all realized that they needn't bother to play hard any more. A draw was all that either team needed in order to avoid relegation. Indeed, to put effort into scoring goals was now positively bad policy, since by taking players away from defence, it carried the risk of actually losing and being relegated after all. Both sides became intent on securing a draw. To quote the same news report, supporters who had been fierce rivals seconds before when Don Gillies fired in an 80th-minute equaliser for Bristol suddenly joined in a combined celebration. Referee Ron Challis watched helpless as the players pushed the ball around with little or no challenge to the man in possession. What had previously been a zero-sum game had suddenly, because of a piece of news from the outside world, become a non-zero-sum game. In the terms of our earlier discussion, it was as if an external banker had magically appeared, making it possible for both Bristol and Coventry to benefit from the same outcome, a draw.
Spectator sports like football are normally zero-sum games for a good reason. It is more exciting for crowds to watch players striving mightily against one another than to watch them conniving amicably. But real life, both human life and plant and animal life, is not set up for the benefit of spectators. Many situations in real life are, as a matter of fact, equivalent to non-zero-sum games. Nature often plays the role of banker, and individuals can therefore benefit from one another's success. They do not have to do down rivals in order to benefit themselves. Without departing from the fundamental laws of the selfish gene, we can see how cooperation and mutual assistance can flourish even in a basically selfish world. We can see how, in Axelrod's meaning of the term, nice guys may finish first. But none of this works unless the game is iterated. The players must know that the present game is not the last one between them. In Axelrod's haunting phrase, the shadow of the future must be long. But how long must it be? It can't be infinitely long. From a theoretical point of view, it doesn't matter how long the game is. The important thing is that neither player should know when the game is going to end. Suppose you and I were playing against each other, and suppose we both knew that the number of rounds in the game was to be exactly 100. Now, we both understand that the 100th round, being the last, will be equivalent to a simple one-off game of Prisoner's Dilemma. Therefore, the only rational strategy for either of us to play on the 100th round will be defect, and we can each assume that the other player will work that out and be fully resolved to defect on the last round. The last round can therefore be written off as predictable. But now, the 99th round will be the equivalent of a one-off game, and the only rational choice for each player on this last but one game is also defect. The 98th round succumbs to the same reasoning, and so on back. Two strictly rational players, each of whom assumes that the other is strictly rational, can do nothing but defect if they both know how many rounds the game is destined to run. For this reason, when games theorists talk about the iterated or repeated prisoner's dilemma game, they always assume that the end of the game is unpredictable, or known only to the banker.
Even if the exact number of rounds in the game is not known for certain, in real life it is often possible to make a statistical guess as to how much longer the game is likely to last. This assessment may become an important part of strategy. If I notice the banker fidget and look at his watch, I may well conjecture that the game is about to be brought to an end, and I may therefore feel tempted to defect. If I suspect that you too have noticed the banker fidgeting, I may fear that you too may be contemplating defection. I will probably be anxious to get my defection in first, especially since I may fear that you are fearing that I, and so on. The mathematician's simple distinction between the one-off prisoner's dilemma game and the iterated prisoner's dilemma game is too simple. Each player can be expected to behave as if he possessed a continuously updated estimate of how long the game is likely to go on. The longer his estimate, the more he will play according to the mathematician's expectations for the true iterated game. In other words, the nicer, more forgiving, less envious he will be. The shorter his estimate of the future of the game, the more he will be inclined to play according to the mathematician's expectations for the one-off game, the nastier and less forgiving will he be.
Axelrod draws a moving illustration of the importance of the shadow of the future from a remarkable phenomenon that grew up during the First World War, the so-called live-and-let-live system. His source is the research of the historian and sociologist Tony Ashworth. It's quite well known that at Christmas, British and German troops briefly fraternized and drank together in no man's land. Less well known, perhaps more interesting, is the fact that unofficial and unspoken non-aggression pacts, a live-and-let-live system, flourished all up and down the front lines for at least 2 years, starting in 1914. A senior British officer on a visit to the trenches is quoted as being astonished to observe German soldiers walking about within rifle range behind their own line.
"Our men appeared to take no notice. I privately made up my mind to do away with that sort of thing when we took over. Such things should not be allowed. These people evidently did not know there was a war on. Both sides apparently believed in the policy of live and let live."
The theory of games and the prisoner's dilemma had not been invented in those days, but with hindsight, we can see pretty clearly what was going on, and Axelrod provides a fascinating analysis. In the entrenched warfare of those times, the shadow of the future for each platoon was long. That is to say, each dug-in group of British soldiers could expect to be facing the same dug-in group of Germans for many months. Moreover, the ordinary soldiers never knew when, if ever, they were going to be moved. Army orders are notoriously arbitrary, capricious, and incomprehensible to those receiving them. The shadow of the future was quite long enough and indeterminate enough to foster the development of a tit-for-tat type of cooperation. Provided, that is, that the situation was equivalent to a game of prisoner's dilemma.
To qualify as a true prisoner's dilemma, remember, the payoffs have to follow a particular rank order. Both sides must see mutual cooperation, CC, as preferable to mutual defection. Defection while the other side cooperates, DC, is even better if you can get away with it. Cooperation while the other side defects, CD, is worst of all. Mutual defection, DD, is what the general staff would like to see. They want to see their own chaps keen as mustard, potting Jerry's, or Tommy's, whenever the opportunity arises. Mutual cooperation was undesirable from the general's point of view because it wasn't helping them to win the war.
but it was highly desirable from the point of view of the individual soldiers on both sides. They didn't want to be shot. Admittedly, and this takes care of the other payoff conditions needed to make the situation a true prisoner's dilemma, they probably agreed with the generals in preferring to win the war rather than lose it, but that is not the choice that faces an individual soldier. The outcome of the entire war is unlikely to be materially affected by what he, as an individual, does. Mutual cooperation with the particular enemy soldiers facing you across no man's land most definitely does affect your own fate, and is greatly preferable to mutual defection, even though you might, for patriotic or disciplinary reasons, marginally prefer to defect, DC, if you could get away with it. It seems that the situation was a true prisoner's dilemma. Something like tit for tat could be expected to grow up, and it did.
The locally stable strategy in any particular part of the trench lines was not necessarily tit-for-tat itself. Tit-for-tat is one of a family of nice, retaliatory, but forgiving strategies, all of which are, if not technically stable, at least difficult to invade once they arise. Three tits for a tat, for instance, grew up in one local area, according to a contemporary account.
We go out at night in front of the trenches. The German working parties are also out, so it is not considered etiquette to fire. The really nasty things are rifle grenades. They can kill as many as 8 or 9 men if they do fall into a trench. But we never use ours unless the Germans get particularly noisy, as on their system of retaliation, 3 for every 1 of ours come back.
It is important for any member of the tit-for-tat family of strategies that the players are punished for defection. The threat of retaliation must always be there. Displays of retaliatory capability were a notable feature of the live-and-let-live system. Crack shots on both sides would display their deadly virtuosity by firing not at enemy soldiers, but at inanimate targets close to the enemy soldiers, a technique also used in Western films, like shooting out candle flames. It does not seem ever to have been satisfactorily answered why the 2 first operational atomic bombs were used, against the strongly voiced wishes of the leading physicists responsible for developing them, to destroy 2 cities instead of being deployed in the equivalent of spectacularly shooting out candles. An important feature of tit-for-tat-like strategies is that they are forgiving. This, as we have seen, helps to damp down what might otherwise become long and damaging runs of mutual recrimination. The importance of damping down retaliation is dramatized by the following memoir by a British, as if the first sentence left us in any doubt, officer.
I was having tea with A Company when we heard a lot of shouting and went to investigate. We found our men and the Germans standing on their respective parapets. Suddenly a salvo arrived but did no damage. Naturally, both sides got down and our men started swearing at the Germans, when all at once a brave German got on his parapet and shouted out, "We are very sorry about that. We hope no one was hurt. It is not our fault. It's that damn Prussian artillery."
Axelrod comments that this apology
goes well beyond a merely instrumental effort to prevent retaliation. It reflects moral regret for having violated a situation of trust, and it shows concern that someone might have been hurt.
Certainly an admirable and very brave German. Axelrod also emphasizes the importance of predictability and ritual in maintaining a stable pattern of mutual trust. A pleasing example of this was the evening gun, fired by British artillery with clockwork regularity at a certain part of the line. In the words of a German soldier,
"At 7 it came, so regularly that you could set your watch by it. It always had the same objective. Its range was accurate. It never varied laterally or went beyond or fell short of the mark. There were even some inquisitive fellows who crawled out a little before 7 in order to see it burst."
The German artillery did just the same thing, as the following account from the British side shows.
So regular were they, the Germans, in their choice of targets, times of shooting, and number of rounds fired that Colonel Jones knew to a minute where the next shell would fall. His calculations were very accurate, and he was able to take what seemed to uninitiated staff officers big risks, knowing that the shelling would stop before he reached the place being shelled.
Axelrod remarks that,
Such rituals of perfunctory and routine firing sent a double message. To the high command, they conveyed aggression, but to the enemy, they conveyed peace.
The live-and-let-live system could have been worked out by verbal negotiation, by conscious strategists bargaining round a table. In fact, it was not. It grew up as a series of local conventions, through people responding to one another's behaviour. The individual soldiers were probably hardly aware that the growing up was going on. This need not surprise us. The strategies in Axelrod's computer were definitely unconscious. It was their behaviour that defined them as nice or nasty, as forgiving or unforgiving, envious or the reverse. The programmers who designed them may have been any of these things, but that is irrelevant. A nice, forgiving, non-envious strategy could easily be programmed into a computer by a very nasty man, and vice versa. A strategy's niceness is recognized by its behavior, not by its motives, for it has none, nor by the personality of its author, who has faded into the background by the time the program is running in the computer. A computer program can behave in a strategic manner without being aware of its strategy or indeed of anything at all.
We are, of course, entirely familiar with the idea of unconscious strategists, at least of strategists whose consciousness, if any, is irrelevant. Unconscious strategists abound in the pages of this book. Axelrod's programs are an excellent model for the way we, throughout the book, have been thinking of animals and plants, and indeed of genes. So it is natural to ask whether his optimistic conclusions about the success of non-envious, forgiving niceness also apply in the world of nature. The answer is yes, of course they do. The only conditions are that nature should sometimes set up games of prisoner's dilemma, that the shadow of the future should be long, and that the games should be non-zero-sum games. These conditions are certainly met all round the living kingdoms. Nobody could ever claim that a bacterium was a conscious strategist, yet bacterial parasites are probably engaged in ceaseless games of prisoner's dilemma with their hosts, and there is no reason why we should not attribute Axelrodian adjectives, forgiving, non-envious, and so on, to their strategies. Axelrod and Hamilton point out that normally harmless or beneficial bacteria can turn nasty, even causing lethal sepsis in a person who is injured. A doctor might say that the person's natural resistance is lowered by the injury. But perhaps the real reason is to do with games of prisoner's dilemma. Do the bacteria perhaps have something to gain, but usually keep themselves in check? In the game between human and bacteria, the shadow of the future is normally long, since a typical human can be expected to live for years from any given starting point. A seriously wounded human, on the other hand, may present a potentially much shorter shadow of the future to his bacterial guests. The temptation to defect correspondingly starts to look like a more attractive option than the reward for mutual cooperation. Needless to say, there is no suggestion that the bacteria work all this out in their nasty little heads. Selection on generations of bacteria has presumably built into them an unconscious rule of thumb which works by purely biochemical means.
Plants, according to Axelrod and Hamilton, may even take revenge, again, obviously unconsciously. Fig trees and fig wasps share an intimate, cooperative relationship. The fig that you eat is not really a fruit. There is a tiny hole at the end, and if you go into this hole, you'd have to be as small as a fig wasp to do so, and they are minute, thankfully too small to notice when you eat a fig. You find hundreds of tiny flowers lining the walls. The fig is a dark indoor hothouse for flowers, an indoor pollination chamber. And the only agents that can do the pollinating are fig wasps. The tree, then, benefits from harbouring the wasps. But what is in it for the wasps? They lay their eggs in some of the tiny flowers, which the larvae then eat. They pollinate other flowers within the same fig. Defecting for a wasp would mean laying eggs in too many of the flowers in a fig and pollinating too few of them. But how could a fig tree retaliate? According to Axelrod and Hamilton,
It turns out in many cases that if a fig wasp entering a young fig does not pollinate enough flowers for seeds and instead lays eggs in almost all, the tree cuts off the developing fig at an early stage. All progeny of the wasp then perish.
A bizarre example of what appears to be a tit-for-tat arrangement in nature was discovered by Eric Fisher in a hermaphrodite fish, the sea bass. Unlike us, these fish don't have their sex determined at conception by their chromosomes. Instead, every individual is capable of performing both female and male functions. In any one spawning episode, they shed either eggs or sperm. They form monogamous pairs and within the pair take turns to play the male and female roles. Now, we may surmise that any individual fish, if it could get away with it, would prefer to play the male role all the time because the male role is cheaper. Putting it another way, an individual that succeeded in persuading its partner to play the female most of the time would gain all the benefits of her economic investment in eggs, while he has resources left over to spend on other things, for instance on mating with other fish. In fact, what Fisher observed was that the fishes operate a system of pretty strict alternation. This is just what we should expect if they're playing tit for tat. And it is plausible that they should, because it does appear that the game is a true prisoner's dilemma, albeit a somewhat complicated one. To play the cooperate card means to play the female role when it is your turn to do so. Attempting to play the male role when it is your turn to play the female is equivalent to playing the defect card. Defection is vulnerable to retaliation. The partner can refuse to play the female role next time it is his turn to do so, or she can simply terminate the whole relationship. Fisher did indeed observe that pairs with an uneven sharing of sex roles tended to break up.
A question that sociologists and psychologists sometimes ask is why blood donors, in countries such as Britain where they are not paid, give blood. I find it hard to believe that the answer lies in reciprocity or disguised selfishness in any simple sense. It is not as though regular blood donors receive preferential treatment when they come to need a transfusion. They are not even issued with little gold stars to wear. Maybe I'm naive, but I find myself tempted to see it as a genuine case of pure disinterested altruism. Be that as it may, blood sharing in vampire bats seems to fit the Axelrod model well. We learn this from the work of G.S. Wilkinson. Vampires, as is well known, feed on blood at night. It is not easy for them to get a meal, but if they do, it is likely to be a big one. When dawn comes, some individuals will have been unlucky and return to the communal roost completely empty, while those individuals that have managed to find a victim are likely to have sucked a surplus of blood. On a subsequent night, the luck may run the other way. So it looks like a promising case for a bit of reciprocal altruism. Wilkinson found that those individuals who struck lucky on any one night did indeed sometimes donate blood by regurgitation to their less fortunate comrades. Out of 110 regurgitations that Wilkinson witnessed, 77 could easily be understood as cases of mothers feeding their children, and many other instances of blood sharing involved other kinds of genetic relatives. There still remained, however, some examples of blood sharing among unrelated bats, cases where the blood is thicker than water explanation would not fit the facts. Significantly, the individuals involved here tended to be frequent roostmates. They had every opportunity to interact with one another repeatedly, as is required for an iterated prisoner's dilemma. But were the other requirements for a prisoner's dilemma met? We can construct a payoff matrix of what we should expect if they were. I defect, you cooperate. Temptation. Very good result. You save my life on my poor night, but then I get the added benefit of not having to pay the slight cost of feeding you on my good night. I cooperate, you defect. Suckers pay off. Very bad result. I pay the cost of saving your life on my good night, but on my bad night you don't feed me, and I run a real risk of starving to death. Both cooperate. Reward. Fairly good result. I get blood on my unlucky nights, which saves me from starving. I have to give blood on my lucky nights, which doesn't cost me too much. Both defect. Punishment. Fairly bad. I don't have to pay the slight costs of feeding you on my good nights, but I run a real risk of starving on my poor nights.
Do vampire economics really conform to this system? Wilkinson looked at the rate at which starved vampires lose weight. From this, he calculated the time it would take a sated bat to starve to death, the time it would take an empty bat to starve to death, and all intermediates. This enabled him to cash out blood in the currency of hours of prolonged life. He found, not really surprisingly, that the exchange rate is different depending on how starved a bat is. A given amount of blood adds more hours to the life of a highly starved bat than to a less starved one. In other words, although the act of donating blood would increase the chances of the donor dying, this increase was small compared with the increase in the recipient's chances of surviving. Economically speaking, then, it seems plausible that vampire economics conform to the rules of a prisoner's dilemma. The blood that the donor gives up is less precious to her, social groups in vampires are female groups, than the same quantity of blood is to the recipient. On her unlucky nights, she really would benefit enormously from a gift of blood, but on her lucky nights, she would benefit slightly, if she could get away with it, from defecting, refusing to donate blood. Getting away with it, of course, means something only if the bats are adopting some kind of tit-for-tat strategy. So, are the other conditions for the evolution of tit-for-tat reciprocation met? In particular, can these bats recognize one another as individuals? Wilkinson did an experiment with captive bats, proving that they can. The basic idea was to take one bat away for a night and starve it while the others were all fed. The unfortunate starved bat was then returned to the roost, and Wilkinson watched to see who, if anyone, gave it food. The experiment was repeated many times, with the bats taking turns to be the starved victim. The key point was that this population of captive bats was a mixture of two separate groups, taken from caves many miles apart. If vampires are capable of recognizing their friends, the experimentally starved bat should turn out to be fed only by those from its own original cave.
This is pretty much what happened. 13 cases of donation were observed. In 12 out of these 13, the donor bat was an old friend of the starved victim, taken from the same cave. In only 1 out of the 13 cases was the starved victim fed by a new friend, not taken from the same cave. Of course, this could be a coincidence, but we can calculate the odds against this. They come to less than 1 in 500. It is pretty safe to conclude that the bats really were biased in favour of feeding old friends rather than strangers from a different cave. Vampires are great myth-makers. To devotees of Victorian Gothic, they are dark forces that terrorise by night, sapping vital fluids, sacrificing an innocent life merely to gratify a thirst. Combine this with that other Victorian myth, nature red in tooth and claw, and aren't vampires the very incarnation of deepest fears about the world of the selfish gene? As for me, I'm sceptical of all myths. If we want to know where the truth lies in particular cases, we have to look. What the Darwinian corpus gives us is not detailed expectations about particular organisms. It gives us something subtler and more valuable, understanding of principle. But if we must have myths, the real facts about vampires could tell a different moral tale. To the bats themselves, not only is blood thicker than water, they rise above the bonds of kinship, forming their own lasting ties of loyal blood brotherhood. Vampires could form the vanguard of a comfortable new myth, a myth of sharing, mutualistic cooperation. They could herald the benignant idea that, even with selfish genes at the helm, nice guys can finish first.
Chapter 13. The long reach of the gene. An uneasy tension disturbs the heart of the selfish gene theory. It is the tension between gene and individual body as fundamental agent of life. On the one hand, we have the beguiling image of independent DNA replicators, skipping like chamois, free and untrammeled down the generations, temporally brought together in throwaway survival machines, immortal coils shuffling off an endless succession of mortal ones as they forge towards their separate eternities. On the other hand, we look at the individual bodies themselves, and each one is obviously a coherent, integrated, and immensely complicated machine with a conspicuous unity of purpose. A body doesn't look like the product of a loose and temporary federation of warring genetic agents who hardly have time to get acquainted before embarking in sperm or egg for the next leg of the great genetic diaspora. It has one single-minded brain which coordinates a cooperative of limbs and sense organs to achieve one end. The body looks and behaves like a pretty impressive agent in its own right. In some chapters of this book, we have indeed thought of the individual organism as an agent striving to maximize its success in passing on all its genes. We imagined individual animals making complicated economic as-if calculations about the genetic benefits of various courses of action. Yet in other chapters, the fundamental rationale was presented from the point of view of genes. Without the gene's eye view of life, there is no particular reason why an organism should care about its reproductive success and that of its relatives, rather than, for instance, its own longevity.
How shall we resolve this paradox of the two ways of looking at life? My own attempt to do so is spelled out in The Extended Phenotype, the book that, more than anything else I've achieved in my professional life, is my pride and joy. This chapter is a brief distillation of a few of the themes in that book, but really I'd almost rather you stop listening now and switch to The Extended Phenotype. On any sensible view of the matter, Darwinian selection does not work on genes directly. DNA is cocooned in proteins, swaddled in membranes, shielded from the world and invisible to natural selection. If selection tried to choose DNA molecules directly, it would hardly find any criterion by which to do so. All genes look alike, just as all recording tapes look alike. The important differences between genes emerge only in their effects. This usually means effects on the processes of embryonic development, and hence on bodily form and behavior. Successful genes are genes that, in the environment influenced by all the other genes in a shared embryo, have beneficial effects on that embryo. Beneficial means that they make the embryo likely to develop into a successful adult, an adult likely to reproduce and pass on those very same genes to future generations. The technical word phenotype is used for the bodily manifestation of a gene, the effect that a gene, in comparison with its alleles, has on the body via development. The phenotypic effect of some particular gene might be, say, green eye colour. In practice, most genes have more than one phenotypic effect, say, green eye colour and curly hair. Natural selection favours some genes rather than others, not because of the nature of the genes themselves, but because of their consequences, their phenotypic effects. Darwinians have usually chosen to discuss genes whose phenotypic effects benefit or penalize the survival and reproduction of whole bodies. They have tended not to consider benefits to the gene itself. This is partly why the paradox at the heart of the theory doesn't normally make itself felt. For instance, a gene may be successful through improving the running speed of a predator. The whole predator's body, including all its genes, is more successful because it runs faster. Its speed helps it survive to have children, and therefore more copies of all its genes, including the genes for fast running, are passed on. Here the paradox conveniently disappears, because what is good for one gene is good for all.
But what if a gene exerted a phenotypic effect that was good for itself but bad for the rest of the genes in the body? This is not a flight of fancy. Cases of it are known. For instance, the intriguing phenomenon called meiotic drive. Meiosis, as you will remember, is the special kind of cell division that halves the number of chromosomes and gives rise to sperm cells or egg cells. Normal meiosis is a completely fair lottery. Of each pair of alleles, only one can be the lucky one that enters any given sperm or egg. But it is equally likely to be either one of the pair, and if you average over lots of sperms or eggs, it turns out that half of them contain one allele, half the other. Meiosis is fair, like tossing a penny. But though we proverbially think of tossing a penny as random, even that is a physical process influenced by a multitude of circumstances. The wind, precisely how hard the penny is flicked, and so on. Meiosis, too, is a physical process, and it can be influenced by genes. What if a mutant gene arose that just happened to have an effect not upon something obvious like eye colour or curliness of hair, but upon meiosis itself? Suppose it happened to bias meiosis in such a way that it, the mutant gene itself, was more likely than its allelic partner to end up in the egg. There are such genes, and they are called segregation distorters. They have a diabolical simplicity. When a segregation distorter arises by mutation, it will spread inexorably through the population at the expense of its allele. It is this that is known as meiotic drive. It will happen even if the effects on bodily welfare and on the welfare of all the other genes in the body are disastrous. Throughout this book, we have been alert to the possibility of individual organisms cheating in subtle ways against their social companions. Here we are talking about single genes cheating against the other genes with which they share a body. The geneticist James Crowe has called them genes that beat the system. One of the best known segregation distorters is the so-called T gene in mice. When a mouse has two T genes, it either dies young or is sterile. T is therefore said to be lethal in the homozygous state. If a male mouse has only one T gene, it will be a normal, healthy mouse, except in one remarkable respect. If you examine such a male's sperms, you will find that up to 95% of them contain the T gene, only 5% the normal allele. This is obviously a gross distortion of the 50% ratio that we expect. Whenever in a wild population a T allele happens to arise by mutation, it immediately spreads like a brush fire. How could it not, when it has such a huge unfair advantage in the meiotic lottery? It spreads so fast that pretty soon large numbers of individuals in the population inherit the T gene in double dose, that is, from both parents. These individuals die or are sterile, and before long the whole local population is likely to be driven extinct. There is some evidence that wild populations of mice have, in the past, gone extinct through epidemics of T genes. Not all segregation distorters have such destructive side effects as T. Nevertheless, most of them have at least some adverse consequences. Almost all genetic side effects are bad, and a new mutation will normally spread only if its bad effects are outweighed by its good effects. If both good and bad effects apply to the whole body, the net effect can still be good for the body. But if the bad effects are on the body and the good effects are on the gene alone, from the body's point of view, the net effect is all bad. In spite of its deleterious side effects, if a segregation distorter arises by mutation, it will surely tend to spread through the population. Natural selection, which after all works at the genic level, favours the segregation distorter, even though its effects at the level of the individual organism are likely to be bad.
Although segregation distorters exist, they aren't very common. We could go on to ask why they aren't common, which is another way of asking why the process of meiosis is normally fair, as scrupulously impartial as tossing a good penny. We'll find that the answer drops out once we have understood why organisms exist anyway. The individual organism is something whose existence most biologists take for granted, probably because its parts do pull together in such a united and integrated way. Questions about life are conventionally questions about organisms. Biologists ask why organisms do this, why organisms do that. They frequently ask why organisms group themselves into societies. They don't ask, though they should, why living matter groups itself into organisms in the first place. Why isn't the sea still a primordial battleground of free and independent replicators? Why did the ancient replicators club together to make and reside in lumbering robots? And why are those robots, individual bodies, you and me, so large and so complicated? It is hard for many biologists even to see that there is a question here at all. This is because it is second nature for them to pose their questions at the level of the individual organism. Some biologists go so far as to see DNA as a device used by organisms to reproduce themselves, just as an eye is a device used by organisms to see. You will recognize that this attitude is an error of great profundity. It is the truth turned crashingly on its head. You may also recognize that the alternative attitude, the selfish gene view of life, has a deep problem of its own. That problem, almost the reverse one, is why individual organisms exist at all, especially in a form so large and coherently purposeful as to mislead biologists into turning the truth upside down. To solve our problem, we have to begin by purging our minds of old attitudes that covertly take the individual organism for granted. Otherwise, we shall be begging the question. The instrument with which we shall purge our minds is the idea that I call the extended phenotype. It is to this, and what it means, that I now turn.
The phenotypic effects of a gene are normally seen as all the effects that it has on the body in which it sits. This is the conventional definition. But we shall now see that the phenotypic effects of a gene need to be thought of as all the effects that it has on the world. It may be that a gene's effects, as a matter of fact, turn out to be confined to the succession of bodies in which the gene sits. But if so, it will be just as a matter of fact. It will not be something that ought to be part of our very definition. In all this, remember that the phenotypic effects of a gene are the tools by which it levers itself into the next generation. All that we are going to add is that the tools may reach outside the individual body wall. What might it mean in practice to speak of a gene as having an extended phenotypic effect on the world outside the body in which it sits? Examples that spring to mind are artifacts like beaver dams, bird nests, and caddis houses. Caddis flies are rather nondescript, drab, brown insects, which most of us fail to notice as they fly rather clumsily over rivers. That is when they are adults. But before they emerge as adults, they have a rather longer incarnation as larvae walking about the river bottom. And caddis larvae are anything but nondescript. They are among the most remarkable creatures on earth. Using cement of their own manufacture, they skillfully build tubular houses for themselves out of materials that they pick up from the bed of the stream. The house is a mobile home, carried about as the caddis walks, like the shell of a snail or hermit crab, except that the animal builds it instead of growing it or finding it. Some species of caddis use sticks as building materials, others fragments of dead leaves, others small snail shells. But perhaps the most impressive caddis houses are the ones built in local stone. The caddis chooses its stones carefully, rejecting those that are too large or too small for the current gap in the wall, even rotating each stone until it achieves the snuggest fit. Incidentally, why does this impress us so? If we forced ourselves to think in a detached way, we surely ought to be more impressed by the architecture of the caddis's eye, or of its elbow joint, than by the comparatively modest architecture of its stone house. After all, the eye and the elbow joint are far more complicated and apparently designed than the house. Yet perhaps because the eye and elbow joint develop in the same kind of way as our own eyes and elbows develop, a building process for which we inside our mothers claim no credit, we are illogically more impressed by the house. Impressed as we may be by the Cadis house, we are nevertheless, paradoxically, less impressed than we would be by equivalent achievements in animals closer to ourselves. Just imagine the banner headlines if a marine biologist were to discover a species of dolphin that wove large, intricately meshed fishing nets 20 dolphin lengths in diameter. Yet we take a spider web for granted, as a nuisance in the house rather than as one of the wonders of the world. And think of the furore if Jane Goodall returned from Gombe Stream with photographs of wild chimpanzees building their own houses, well-roofed and insulated, of painstakingly selected stones neatly bonded and mortared. Yet Cadis larvae, who do precisely that, command only passing interest. It is sometimes said, as though in defence of this double standard, that spiders and caddises achieve their feats of architecture by instinct. But so what? In a way, this makes them all the more impressive.
Let us get back to the main argument. The Cadis house, nobody could doubt, is an adaptation evolved by Darwinian selection. It must have been favoured by selection in very much the same way as, say, the hard shell of lobsters was favoured. It is the protective covering for the body. As such, it is of benefit to the whole organism and all its genes. But we have now taught ourselves to see benefits to the organism as incidental, as far as natural selection is concerned. The benefits that actually count are the benefits to those genes that give the shell its protective properties. In the case of the lobster, this is the usual story. The lobster's shell is obviously a part of its body. But what about the Cadis house? Natural selection favoured those ancestral Cadis genes that caused their possessors to build effective houses. The genes worked on behaviour, presumably by influencing the embryonic development of the nervous system. But what a geneticist would actually see is the effect of genes on the shape and other properties of houses. The geneticist should recognise genes for house shape in precisely the same sense as there are genes for, say, leg shape. Admittedly, nobody has actually studied the genetics of Cadis houses. To do so, you would have to keep careful pedigree records of Cadises bred in captivity, and breeding them is difficult. But you don't have to study genetics to be sure that there are, or at least were, genes influencing differences between Cadis houses. All you need is good reason to believe that the Cadis house is a Darwinian adaptation. In that case, there must have been genes controlling variation in Cadis houses, for selection cannot produce adaptations unless there are hereditary differences among which to select.
Although geneticists may think it an odd idea, it is therefore sensible for us to speak of genes for stone shape, stone size, stone hardness, and so on. Any geneticist who objects to this language must, to be consistent, object to speaking of genes for eye colour, genes for wrinkling in peas, and so on. One reason the idea might seem odd, in the case of stones, is that stones are not living material. Moreover, the influence of genes upon stone properties seems especially indirect. A geneticist might wish to claim that the direct influence of the genes is upon the nervous system that mediates the stone-choosing behaviour, not upon the stones themselves. But such a geneticist should look carefully at what it can ever mean to speak of genes exerting an influence on a nervous system. All that genes can really influence directly is protein synthesis. A gene's influence upon a nervous system, or for that matter upon the colour of an eye or the wrinkliness of a pea, is always indirect. The gene determines a protein sequence that influences X, that influences Y, that influences Z, that eventually influences the wrinkliness of the seed, or the cellular wiring up of the nervous system. The Cadis house is only a further extension of this kind of sequence. Stone hardness is an extended phenotypic effect of the Cadis's genes. If it is legitimate to speak of a gene as affecting the wrinkliness of a pea or the nervous system of an animal, all geneticists think it is, then it must also be legitimate to speak of a gene as affecting the hardness of the stones in a caddis house. Startling thought, isn't it? Yet the reasoning is inescapable. We are ready for the next step in the argument. Genes in one organism can have extended phenotypic effects on the body of another organism. Caddis houses helped us take the previous step. Snail shells will help us take this one. The shell plays the same role for a snail as the stone house does for a caddis larva. It is secreted by the snail's own cells, so a conventional geneticist would be happy to speak of genes for shell qualities such as shell thickness. But it turns out that snails parasitized by certain kinds of fluke, flatworm, have extra thick shells. What can this thickening mean? If the parasitized snails had had extra thin shells, we'd happily explain this as an obvious debilitating effect on the snail's constitution. But a thicker shell? A thicker shell presumably protects the snail better. It looks as though the parasites are actually helping their host by improving its shell. But are they? We have to think more carefully. If thicker shells are really better for the snail, why don't they have them anyway? The answer probably lies in economics. Making a shell is costly for a snail. It requires energy. It requires calcium and other chemicals that have to be extracted from hard-won food. All these resources, if they were not spent on making shell substance, could be spent on something else, such as making more offspring. The snail that spends lots of resources on making an extra thick shell has bought safety for its own body, but at what cost? It may live longer, but it will be less successful at reproducing and may fail to pass on its genes. Among the genes that fail to be passed on will be the genes for making extra thick shells. In other words, it is possible for a shell to be too thick as well as, more obviously, too thin. So when a fluke makes a snail secrete an extra thick shell, the fluke is not doing the snail a good turn unless the fluke is bearing the economic cost of thickening the shell. And we can safely bet that it isn't being so generous. The fluke is exerting some hidden chemical influence on the snail that forces the snail to shift away from its own preferred thickness of shell. It may be prolonging the snail's life, but it's not helping the snail's genes.
What is in it for the fluke? Why does it do it? My conjecture is the following. Both snail genes and fluke genes stand to gain from the snail's bodily survival, all other things being equal. But survival is not the same thing as reproduction, and there is likely to be a trade-off. Whereas snail genes stand to gain from the snail's reproduction, fluke genes don't. This is because any given fluke has no particular expectation that its genes will be housed in its present host's offspring. They might be, but so might those of any of its fluke rivals. Given that snail longevity has to be bought at the cost of some loss in the snail's reproductive success, the fluke genes are happy to make the snail pay that cost, since they have no interest in the snail's reproducing itself. The snail genes are not happy to pay that cost, since their long-term future depends upon the snail reproducing. So I suggest that fluke genes exert an influence on the shell-secreting cells of the snail, an influence that benefits themselves, but is costly to the snail's genes. This theory is testable, though it hasn't been tested yet. We are now in a position to generalize the lesson of the caddises. If I am right about what the fluke genes are doing, it follows that we can legitimately speak of fluke genes as influencing snail bodies, in just the same sense as snail genes influence snail bodies. It is as if the genes reached outside their own body and manipulated the world outside. As in the case of the caddises, this language might make geneticists uneasy. They are accustomed to the effects of a gene being limited to the body in which it sits. But, again as in the case of the caddises, a close look at what geneticists ever mean by a gene having effects shows that such uneasiness is misplaced. We need to accept only that the change in snail shell is a fluke adaptation. If it is, it has to have come about by Darwinian selection of fluke genes. We have demonstrated that the phenotypic effects of a gene can extend not only to inanimate objects like stones, but to other living bodies too.
The story of the snails and flukes is only the beginning. Parasites of all types